Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We have had 28 Democrats vying for the party's presidential nomination. Just over a week ago, Bernie Sanders seemed to be the clear frontrunner after three very strong primary performances. Then came some prominent withdrawals from the race and the resurgence, really the resurrection, of Joe Biden in last week's primaries. What will happen next is entirely up in the air. Joe Biden could keep riding this new wave of momentum, or we could be headed for a contested convention, something that we have not seen in many decades. Amy Davidson Sorkin is a political columnist for The New Yorker, and she's going to help us with a little civics refresher course.
You know, there's a lot of states left to vote, and you've sewn up the nomination when you get 1,991 of the pledged delegates.
When you cast your vote in a primary, you're not really voting for the candidate so much as you're voting for a delegate who's pledged to that candidate, as long as that person is still in the race when the convention comes. And then things can get really complex.
You go to the convention with a certain number of delegates who are pledged to you. So everybody gets the convention and they vote. If nobody has a majority, then there's a second ballot. But on that ballot, there's another factor, the superdelegates. They don't get to vote on the first ballot. They get to vote on the second ballot.
The superdelegates are Democratic insiders, members of Congress, senators, higher-ups in the party. There are nearly 800 superdelegates at the convention. And if they get to vote, it's a whole new ballgame. Now, Amy, does it go without saying that the superdelegates are going to be in greatest proportion on the side of Joe Biden as opposed to Bernie Sanders?
If it was today, but who knows what might happen on the campaign trail? What could be revealed? What could come out? You know, a lot of the people who are the superdelegates, they voted, in a sense, ahead of Super Tuesday by coming out and endorsing Biden, getting their local networks activated for him. Klobuchar did that, too, apparently, in Minnesota. She didn't just say that she wanted people to vote for him. She helped get out the vote. So is that a conspiracy or is that a party acting like a party and saying, you know, we know this person, we have this sense of how it's going to have this effect on races in this state. We're making a judgment about what the party stands for as well.
Well, in your view, is it part of democracy or anti-democratic in some way?
I mean, how purely democratic is it that four states that were in different ways not entirely representative of the whole country had so much say? We're New Yorkers. This might be settled by the time it gets to us. So there are a lot of ways that the democracy here is imperfect.
When's the last time we had a contested convention?
I believe it was 1952 for the Democrats, 1948 for the Republicans. But, you know, both of those nominated a candidate on the third ballot. So it was contested, but it wasn't an epic contest.
It wasn't like a Fletcher Nebel novel that goes to the 50th ballot.
Yeah, there was the classic, the one that, you know, people dream of and has entered the realm of contested convention legend is the 1924 Democratic convention, which went to, wait for it, 103 ballots. and neither one of the front runners got it.
What happened? Who was running against
whom? It was William McAdoo versus Al Smith. And there were a lot of issues, you know, prohibition, a lot of other issues. But the thing that broke the convention was the Ku Klux Klan. McAdoo wanted the Klan's support. And he basically killed an anti-Klan plank in the party's platform. And that caused a shift where there are people who were opposed to him but might have reached some sort of deal, became just opposed to him on principle, and rightly so. And they just kept going until they finally, both of them withdrew.
Who won the nomination and how did it end up in the general election?
John Davis, congressman from West Virginia, who lost badly to Calvin Coolidge. But it was probably better for American history that the Democrats didn't coalesce around somebody who was sort of cozy with the Klan. You know, even if you're going to go into the election divided, but believing something you actually believe in, that's worth it. I'd hasten to say that that's not the case with any of the candidates on the Democratic side right now. Unless you really feel strongly about democratic socialism, the party's not at a point where the divides are like so existential, so much about the fundamental values of the party.
Biden's argument is, I'm the guy that can unite the party, bring in independents, win those counties that went over to Trump. I can do it.
Because, maybe you can.
Because I'm embracing. Sanders' argument of the case is, I will expand the electorate, that I will bring in new voters, many of them young. What do you think of those two cases?
Both of them have things to recommend them. I wouldn't mock either of them. Even in states that Biden won significantly, Sanders did well with younger voters. And those are going to be the voters who inherit the parties. They can't be alienated. Biden is going to have to make some choices about how he talks about Bernie. Remember, he's going to be propelled forward possibly by a lot of money from Mike Bloomberg, a man who on the debate stage called Bernie akin to a communist and a threat to the
country.
Which
was ridiculous.
You know, so is that what he wants the ads that are going to be in every state paid for by Bloomberg to be saying, that the choice is, how does Biden now talk about democratic socialism? You know, just, it's not going to be enough now to just be the decent, kind human being who you'd rather have in the White House than Donald Trump. This is not going to be an easy election.
It's going to be hideous and ugly.
It's just, we're still in a quite uncertain period, I think. This is not just going to be cruising along till November and then people decide whether they like the excitement of Trump or the niceness of Biden. It goes in a more fundamental way to what people want from politics and their tolerance for discord.
Amy Davidson Sorkin, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Amy Davidson Sorkin is a staff writer and a political columnist for The New Yorker. The possibility of a contested convention highlights the long-standing state of tension in the Democratic Party between the moderate center and the more progressive left wing. We have on the one hand Joe Biden, who touts his ability to work across party lines. And then there's Bernie Sanders, a Vermont independent who identifies himself almost defiantly as a Democratic socialist. I'm joined now by Michael Kazin, a historian at Georgetown University. Kazin has written extensively about the labor movement and populism, and he's the author of America Divided, The Civil War of the 1960s. Michael, how do you interpret the pretty bad results for Sanders on Super Tuesday through the prism of his declaration of himself as a Democratic Socialist? Does that hurt him? What seemed to be an asset for many voters initially, and particularly his core supporters, is that turning out to be a detriment to his campaign?
Well, the problem is that he has an identity, which is very strong and which attracts a lot of people, and authenticity, which attracts a lot of people. But that's also a drawback because he is a protest candidate against his party's establishment, a protest candidate against the establishment of the country, the economic establishment, the media establishment, the political establishment. And protest candidates, demand that you do a lot. They demand that you believe that their protests can be turned into effective governance. And in this situation, of course, as we all know, Democrats are primarily concerned, whatever their views, even if a lot of people who call themselves socialists, primarily concerned with the short-term aim of making sure Donald Trump doesn't get a second term. And that's, I think, the primary reason why he has, so far at least, topped out at about 30-35% of the Democratic electorate.
Now, he said the theory of his case is that he will grow the electorate in ways that haven't been seen before. Is he floundering in that attempt?
So far, he certainly is. So far, he's getting no greater number of young people voting for him this year as did in 2016, for example. And older people are pretty much flocking to other candidates, especially Joe Biden.
You're a historian of the American left through the 19th and 20th centuries. You edit Dissent, which is a left-leaning political and cultural criticism magazine. You understand this field and its history. Is Bernie Sanders a socialist, and what does that mean?
I think he's part of the socialist tradition. That is, he identifies with the idea that workers should have a lot more power, that the government should help them get more power, that there should be as large a welfare state as possible. His hero used to be Eugene Debs, the socialist who ran five times for president on the Socialist Party ticket. But really, more and more as he's evolved from his youth, when he was a young socialist in the 1960s, he's become more of what Europeans would call a social democrat, though that term has never been really popular in this country. That is, he is not in favor of doing away with capitalism, with entrepreneurship, even with all rich people, though he doesn't like billionaires very much, but millionaires he's probably okay with. He's a millionaire himself, actually, because of his book publishing. And I think he really wants a larger welfare state. He wants stronger trade unions. He wants the kind of thing that he said often, that citizens of Denmark and Finland, Sweden, and Germany take for granted.
Now, you mentioned that Eugene V. Debs was his hero back when. The figure that he alludes to now all the time, even when he gave a kind of keynote address on socialism and democratic socialism, is none other than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, my understanding of Roosevelt, we could probably argue this all day and night, is that Roosevelt was not only a member of the Democratic Party, but he was a liberal.
That's quite true. Really, it's from the New Deal that modern liberalism, which has a much larger role for the central government in the economy, it's from that point that we think about a definition of modern liberalism, which it still has right now, 80 years later. So I think by evoking FDR, Sanders is trying to identify himself with what was a very popular current in American political life, the idea that government should take care of people, should help them find housing, should help them find a job if they need one, should cover them with health care. And so he's, even though he called himself a socialist, he's able to identify with the closest thing as we've ever gotten to a social democratic politics.
But why, if his hero is FDR, does he refuse to identify himself as a liberal if FDR did? Is it a matter of branding in a sense, or is it a matter of firm ideological conviction?
Good question. I think liberalism has become associated since the 1960s with a very defensive kind of politics, especially a politics which is more identified with helping racial minorities, LGBT people, with feminism. And Bernie is very much about economic uplift, economic power for working people.
Identity is not his main concern.
No. In fact, one of the reasons why in Super Tuesday he won only a minority of black votes, I think, is because he is not identified with primarily focusing on issues that perhaps are most important to black people especially. And also, I think you know, he's also somebody who wants to have his own identifier. he wants to popularize the idea of democratic socialism. And if you're a liberal, then historically you see yourself as opposed to democratic socialism. That's going too far, and he wants to go far.
Now, when I was in college, I was very fond of a political organization called the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee. As if Irving Howe or Michael Harrington were somehow going to become president. It seemed a very marginal and distant thing, and maybe a relic of the age that had come before me, which is the kind of 60s and 70s era. And now you see polls that, particularly among young people, not only, but particularly among young people, that words like socialism and democratic socialism are attractive to a great number of people. Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, I think. Part of it starts with the Great Recession, certainly, which made young people especially feel that maybe capitalism not so great after all. Part of it, too, ironically, I think, is the fact that Barack Obama, who a lot of young people liked, at least in 2008, young people on the left, was called a socialist. And there's all these memes about him and, you know, images on the internet of Obama standing next to Lenin and Marx and Lenin and
Yeah, but one thing Barack Obama never called himself. was a socialist.
No, but...
he was called a socialist by his enemies.
I know, but language and political identifiers work in unusual ways sometimes. And I think the fact that Obamacare specifically was called socialism by a lot of Republicans made some young people say, well, you know, Obamacare is not enough, but we certainly like the idea of national health insurance, which Obamacare is supposed to institute. So let's go further. And also, I think there's a sense really, and this is true in Europe as well as the United States, that the more traditional kinds of political philosophies, whether they are conservative republicanism of the Reagan era or a kind of liberal democratic view that Obama had, that they have failed. And so a lot of young people want something which will really be a break with a system they feel has not served them, which they feel, you know, they, of course, are very critical of what's happening with the environment and the idea that capitalism is not going to solve the problem of climate change. You need a much more collective, government-driven set of solutions to that. So a lot of young people say, well, let's try something different. Let's try something really different from capitalism. And if we can get a president elected like Bernie Sanders who agrees with those aspirations, that'll be wonderful.
Let's look to the future now. You wrote an op-ed in the New York Times where you said that Bernie Sanders has already won, arguing that whether he captures the White House or not, he's transformed the Democratic Party. What did you mean by that specifically in policy terms?
Well, I think you look at the debates that the Democrats have had, these long, somewhat boring debates. There won't be too many more of them, I hope. You find that on health care, for example, every candidate on the stage, even the more conservative ones, like Michael Bloomberg, were saying they were for a robust public option or Medicare for all. All of them wanted some debt relief. All of them supported laws to make it easier to organize labor unions. All of them talked about taking much more aggressive action about climate change. So in these ways, I think the kind of platform that Bernie Sanders ran on in 2016 and is running on this year has moved the party to the left. It's made the party, gotten the party closer to what a social democratic party in Europe would stand for. And in that sense, as the headline, which I didn't write in the Times, said, he's already won. He's already transformed the party. The only way I think he won't transform the party is if he gets nominated and loses the way George McGovern lost in 1972.
Gets wiped out.
He's wiped out. But I don't expect that to happen because we're a very different country than 1972. There are states which will never vote for a Democrat and states that will never vote for a Republican, like California, like Maryland, like New York State, for example. And he's going to win those states. Even if he lost by 10 points in the popular vote, he'd still win those states. So it wouldn't be a blowout the way it was for McGovern.
I won't reduce you as an esteemed scholar to a pundit in my realm, but after Tuesday and going forward, do you expect him to get the nomination?
I like to say, as an historian, I don't have to predict the future. So I only have to explain the past, which is difficult enough.
You're ducking it.
I think that both Sanders and Biden are weak candidates in many ways, unfortunately, I say as a Democrat. And they both have many liabilities. And I don't know. I mean, after all, there have been close races in the recent past Democrats have had where we didn't know whether in 2008, whether Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton would win the nomination. For a while, it looked like Hillary Clinton would. And then Barack Obama started winning some primaries and caucuses. Then Hillary Clinton came back and won some. I don't really know, David. I think that we'll have to see what happens with these larger states. And we'll have to see also if Elizabeth Warren supports Bernie Sanders in a major way. And that could help convince some people on the progressive side who have been leery about Bernie Sanders, perhaps partly because he called himself a socialist, to be more supportive of him.
Given Super Tuesday, where does Bernie go from here, do you think?
I think he has to enlarge his base.
How does he go about doing that? When his message is so consistent, his style is so consistent, you can't fault him for being all over the map. How does he broaden his base?
I think he has to assure people. I think he has to find some way within himself, and this is not really part of his personality, to make people feel that he is not going to do away with things they care about. For example, he could talk about a transition to Medicare for All rather than saying Medicare for all is all we're going to say. We're not going to ever compromise with it.
But then you, forgive me, but then you're talking about Medicare for all for those who want it, or whatever Pete Buttigieg used as the term. And he goes back on his consistency.
Yes, but I think his core followers will go along with that. His core followers are, especially when, if the two candidate race between Bernie and Joe Biden, they're not going to go to Joe Biden. so they trust him enough, I think, to make certain changes. They realize, you know, he's running for the most powerful office in the world, and he's going to have to compromise to a certain degree. The question is whether he compromises on his ends as opposed to how you get to his ends.
Will Bernie Sanders embrace Joe Biden if Joe Biden wins, and vice versa?
They've both said they'll support whoever the candidate is. What's really matters, of course, is
their supporters.
Their supporters will. Yeah. Yeah. And there is a problem. You know, a divided party, a party that's divided at the convention, never has won in American politics. And that's a real problem.
Michael Kazin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Historian Michael Kazin of Georgetown University. His book, America Divided, about the 1960s, is now out in paperback. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. There's an old reporter saying that prediction is the lowest form of journalism. Now, I wouldn't swear by that, but there's certainly some truth in it, at least. Fiction, however, is an entirely different story. When it comes to predicting what the future is going to look like and be like and feel like, fiction might be the way to go. And nobody in our time can beat the novelist William Gibson at prediction. Gibson's new novel is called Agency. Here's Josh Rothman, an editor at The New Yorker.
When William Gibson came up with the term cyberspace in the late 70s, there was no real internet to speak of. He'd been walking around Vancouver, which is where he lived, and he'd noticed kids playing video games in video arcades. And he noticed that when you went to a video arcade and you watched the kids, they would duck and weave as though they were in the game. And that alone was enough to get into his mind the idea that, yeah, we want to be in there. We want to be in the computer world. And in fact, that's true. We do want to live in the computer world. So much of what we've done with this technology over the last 30 years, 35 years, has been about finding new ways to merge the digital space and the real space. Finding ways to take a selfie and get it into the digital world as quickly as possible. He would be the first person to say he got a lot of technical details wrong about cyberspace. He pictured it as a virtual world, like a VR, like Tron. And that's not what it turned out to be. It turned out to be the browser on your phone. But what he got right was that people really want to be in a virtual world all the time. They're always thinking about wanting to be in a virtual world. And the thing is that, you know, that seems really futuristic, but it was true in 1979 in Vancouver. You just had to see it. And that's Gibson's, you know, special superpower. Just to look at the world that we're in right now and to notice the parts of it that are futuristic. Gibson's idea is if you want to see the future, you don't have to picture some totally different world. You just have to take seriously what you know already is coming. Like the scientists say, climate change is coming. That's the future. And one of the things you have to do, therefore, is you have to constantly update your sense of what the present is. You have to really look at the present and take it on board. And that means that sometimes things happen in the present and they really mess up your concept of what the future was going to be. And that's what happened to Gibson when he was writing his new book.
This book mutated out of the book that I was writing the night of our most recent presidential election.
I spoke to William Gibson a couple of weeks ago at a reading in Brooklyn.
I had a book that I was thinking of as sort of a romp, and I woke up in the morning and I realized that I'd never be able to write that book because that book was set in 2017, and I thought the zeitgeist I was working with is gone. Most people haven't noticed it yet, but it's gone. And by 2017, it'll be like really gone. After, you know, about 3 months of deep unhappiness, I realized one day that I was feeling a complete sense of unreality. Like I did not believe at that moment in the news feed. And I thought, this is bullshit. This can't be happening. I'm dreaming. And then I thought, no, I'm having a surgical procedure. And they've got me way down under, but I'm starting to come up. And that's why I'm starting to question this ludicrous drugged reality that, and then I thought, no, this shit's real. And I looked over at the laptop that contained my, I thought, dead novel, and I thought, what if Verity and Eunice are living in a stub in which that election went the other way?
So in Gibson's new book, it's called Agency, there are two time periods. There's the future and there's the present, and they've contacted each other. And the idea in the book is, whenever the future contacts the past, it makes a new timeline. It kind of makes a divergence, like a fork in the road. And this new timeline is called a stub. The people in the future have an interest in what's happening in these stubs. And that's because what lies between the stubs and them, or between us and the future, is something that Gibson calls the jackpot. And the jackpot is Gibson's term for basically, you know, the end of civilization and the natural world as we know it.
Are people happier there? She asked. Happier than they were here, then. I gather they aren't, particularly. Pity, she said. Ready for tilapia tacos? Place on Tottenham Court Road. Better Mexican in your new stub, no doubt. Why aren't they happy there? The drivers for the jackpot are still in place, but with less talk at that particular point. He took a seat at the table. They're still a bit in advance of the pandemics, at least. She took the seat opposite. Nothing before the 2020s has ever seemed entirely real to me. Hard to imagine they weren't constantly happy, given all they still had. Tigers, for instance.
So if you think about, like, a Michael Bay disaster movie, you know, it's one thing that does us in, like an asteroid or a plague or, you know, aliens, something like that, one thing. But that's not how Gibson thinks about this. The idea of the jackpot is, if some of the stuff you read about in the paper that's happening right now already, if all those scary things just keep happening, you get the jackpot. The reason it's called the jackpot is it's because, you know, it's like in the slot machine. If everything comes up cherries, if it turns out that the oceans do rise quite a lot, coronavirus actually is really bad, and there's actually many other coronaviruses. A lot of wildfires do happen and continue to happen. The hurricanes really are pretty bad. 80% of people die, and the result is a world that's clawing its way back, that's trying to survive and rebuild. It looks like this.
To the horizon stretched a regularly spaced array of towers, roughly similar in height, through which, she saw, lowering her gaze, wound a river's serpentine curves. There, said Rainey, pointing out something Verity couldn't distinguish. London Eye, only tall thing aside from the original shard that you'll have seen before. They took down what was left of the rest. These are called shards, too, after the first one. Relatively few are habitations. What are they? Windows were lit, a few, if the lights she saw were windows. They scrub the air, the woman said, behind them, now standing. an older, lower city at the feet of the towers, like Lycan in comparison. There were forests, too, she saw, with greenways between them. "That's the Thames?" "Of course," said Rainey. But with more bridges, at least two of them planted with what looked like forests of their own, and tributaries, none of which Verity remembered. Some of them appeared to have been roofed with glass, illuminated. "CG," Verity said. "VR, AR, a game." "That's the commonest initial assumption," the woman said, on first seeing it, "though I suppose natives of eras earlier than yours might assume dream, hallucination, visit to a supernatural realm." "You're saying it's the future?" "Entertain the idea, to one side, so to speak. A mere possibility."
Gibson isn't saying that this is inevitable, that there's no possible future but this future. He's just saying, if you look at what's happening right now, this certainly seems to be eminently reasonable.
You're in a unique position of being someone who for a really long time has thought about and imagined the future. And how has that changed? How has our idea of the future changed over that span?
Well, something that I find quite significant is that, you know, my childhood self watching the wooden TV would hear or see the phrase "the 21st century" virtually every day, often several times every day, often with one or more exclamation points following it. It's like, it's coming, the 21st century. This is back like in 1953 or something. And how often do you hear the phrase "the 22nd century"? Don't hear it. Currently, we don't have a future in that sense. We no longer have that sort of cultural anticipation that we took for granted through most of the 20th century.
I mean, I sometimes feel that the future is sort of claustrophobically foretold. So, like, I think of, like, the Elon Musk future, yeah, which is, you know, all-powerful artificial intelligence takes over everything, and climate change happens and all the terrible things that will come from that happen. And in that sense, it feels like the future, it's almost hard to think about because it feels closed off. I wonder, is that how you feel about the future?
It isn't. Well, something I've watched, having been a science fiction fan since I was 12 or 13, I began to realize that when science fiction writers got old, they started to complain about the world ending and everything going to hell in a handbasket. And it seemed to me that probably when everyone gets old, the world does end because the world they grew up in starts to go away. But then there's this thing of sort of transferring all of that onto a younger generation. So yeah, the world is ending, but young folks today, you know, what can you expect? That's ancient. Well, it turns out that's ancient. You know, you can find that on pot sherds from Babylon. It's always been going on. You can find it in ancient Greece. So I put it at the top of my list of kind of don't do things. Like, when you get old, don't be that guy. Don't be that guy, because it's bullshit. Like, things are gonna go forward. And I think I was right, but now I find myself old and looking at a situation that really does not look good. And it has, like all of those grumpy old sci-fi uncles of mine, I heard moaning in the 70s and 80s about, you know, how the world was going to hell in a handbasket. they still believed in a future. And now I'd like to believe in a future. And again, I kind of go, well, human nature, and kind of look at some of the worst examples of that around these days, and it doesn't really look good. And so I'm torn between believing that I'm just doing what the uncles have always done, and that I'm recognizing something that we haven't ever as a species actually seen before.
The novelist William Gibson. He spoke with The New Yorker's Joshua Rothman at a live event at Murmur Theater in Brooklyn. Gibson's new book, Agency, is out now.
Friends, they come and go.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and in a minute, our music editor talks with the artist known as Thundercat. Stick around. You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
I feel kind of fly standing next to you. Baby girl, how do I look in my do-rag? Would you tell me the truth? Stay with me and love me through the night.
That's music by Thundercat from his album coming out next month called It Is What It Is. Thundercat has cut an unusual path for himself. He was born Stephen Lee Bruner, and started out playing bass with his father, who had played drums with Diana Ross and the Temptations. Bruner was in a boy band and then, strangely enough, moved on to a punk band called Suicidal Tendencies. As a session bassist, he worked with Erykah Badu, Childish Gambino, and the late rapper Mac Miller, who was also a close friend of his. Thundercat's particular way of merging jazz, R&B, funk, and hip-hop caught the attention of Kendrick Lamar, and they collaborated on Lamar's record To Pimp a Butterfly. Brianna Younger writes and edits music coverage for The New Yorker, and she talked with Thundercat last year while he was on a week-long residency at the Blue Note Jazz Club in New York.
I guess we'll start with where we are now, like with you in the midst of this residency. Like, how has that been going so far? Like, this is your first residency of this caliber?
Yeah.
Oh, ever?
Yeah, like I've never had a residency before.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So people know you from To Pimp a Butterfly. A lot of people, at least, were introduced to you that way. But you also, you know, have a long resume from Suicidal Tendencies to playing with Erykah Badu. But let's go to the very, very beginning. And what even made you pick up a bass to begin with?
Well, I think I just had a natural affinity for, like, swords and, you know, sticks. You know, it's like there's that one kid that, you know, like you always got to tell him to put stuff down, or he's just playing a little too rough with things. There's a bit of that, but then there's also mostly my dad that inspired me, because it's like growing up in a house of musicians, you know, it's not saying that, it's indirectly saying you're going to play an instrument. Like, it doesn't matter, you know, it's intense, you know, and it's like it's not always for the faint of heart. when you have a family that does music, because everybody has an opinion, you know, everybody feels things differently, and you have to respect that. But, you know, it's like, it's just, you learn and you grow. You still grow and learn together, but it's like, it's just different. Me and my older brother would grow up playing together more than me and my younger brother. And in growing up with my older brother being, you know, that he's this virtuoso drummer, it was very intimidating, but it caused me to grow. You know, if I didn't have my brother around, I wouldn't play the way I play.
Mm-hmm. So some of your early records, like Young Jazz Giants, sound more in the vein of traditional jazz than, you know, as your work as Thundercat. How did you develop that sound and what would become the Thundercat voice over time?
The real thing is that I started writing music for my instrument. And a lot of the time when you have an instrument that you play, it can become a bit of a role, you know, where, like I was saying, you start to fall into the idea of, like, I'm working, so it's cool. But I would push out a bit, you know, and because I didn't play piano, you know, because I wasn't like this guy trying to be this R&B singer, I would always create from my bass. And once I realized that that was an option, it kind of took over, took on its own life.
You've talked in the past about kind of your decision to play six strings versus four strings and how, like, in your collaborations with other artists, that was kind of a thing where people may have wanted you to play more contained or essentially to shrink yourself. So why the six string? Like, what are some of the nuances of that, and how has it allowed you to become the artist that you saw yourself as?
It's like, you know, like I would say, like, sometimes when people see the six string, it's immediately intimidating, or it's immediately denotes to you're about to play too much. It's just like, you know, but a lot of the time I would be writing and that would be the best tool to write with for me because it gave me the most facility. And I wouldn't always take it out with me, but I would always be playing a six string on records that I would record for myself. It didn't become a reality until I had my other basses stolen, where I had to take that bass out, and that's where it started.
So your sense of humor is such a big part of what people know of you. Like, it's in your records, it's in your interviews. Like, anytime people hear Thundercat, it's a very lighthearted kind of situation, but, you know, life gets real, and that's also in the records, and
yeah.
I feel like Drunk was, like, the perfect culmination of... I'm this funny guy, but also it's not always great.
Yeah.
Nobody move, there's blood on the floor. And I can't find my heart. Where did it go? Did I leave it in the cold? So please give it back, cause it's not yours to take.
You know, music sometimes can be like therapy. It can be, you know, soft and gentle, or it can be really, you know, intense and abrasive. And I don't know. I feel like humor is for the soul. You know what I mean? Like, it helps you get through. Even if it hurts, it's still better to laugh, I think.
One of the hardest things that I would imagine about being an artist is those tough times and the idea that you're expected to kind of process things in this very public way.
Yeah.
Obviously you've dealt with a lot of loss in your lifetime, but is that something you're feeling now with the recent loss of Mac and this idea that you'll be expected to somehow process this on your next record?
Well, I think it's the inevitable, first of all. It's like real life and art, you know, the imitation thing is real. I don't think it's expected. I mean, if I put out a trap album next, I would imagine that's just as expected.
Fair enough.
But it's moments like that, it's just what it is. It is what it is. I can't make up for something as precious as a life lost like Max. You know, it's no way it's not going to touch different places in my life, you know. There was a movie that came out some years ago with Denzel Washington and John Goodman, and it was about this, like, demon that would follow him through the city.
Oh, Fallen?
Fallen, you remember it. There were moments, like, after he died that felt a bit like Fallen or like They Live, because it was like everybody was in my personal life in that one moment, and I couldn't walk down the street without somebody looking and saying, I'm sorry, or like trying to catch my eyes. And it was a bit intense for me at first, but the truth is everybody mourns, you know, and Mac didn't just touch my life. That was just what that was proof of. And I had to see through that, you know, and like realize it is bigger. Again, it's bigger than me, you know. So my processing of it is, like I said, it's going to get touched.
Now I'm sitting here with a black hole in my chest. A heartless, broken mess.
Back to To Pimp a Butterfly. Was that different than anything you've done prior?
Oh, yeah. That was a very demanding moment, you know. To this day, I still think, I look back on it and I think about how much output was going on in that moment. And along with that, you know, realizing that that is the genius of Kendrick Lamar's writing. And like, it's rare, you know, it's like a lot of the time, especially in the rap game, rappers get far off into thinking it's just them. Kendrick was not afraid of anything. Like, and that would inspire me all the time. He would run up on all of it. We would have conversations about Joe Henderson. We have, you know, talk about those Miles albums. We'd talk about all kinds of stuff like that. It was just this continuous dance of like, just, it was almost like a trust fall. It was like, I didn't know where I was going. And it was one of those things where when that album was finished, being there for the very last mastering session up until 7-8 o'clock in the morning, and I went home, I just almost fainted and cried because it was just so, I was like, I had gone as far as I felt I could. I had given as all I could. You know, if I had lost like 100 pounds, that would have made sense, you know, but it was just like, I put my all. That's what I have from that, you know. It's like, and then we look up and then it's, you know, it's like, oh, 11 Grammys. We were like, Jesus, you know, it's like,
I was gonna say, did you know it would be this?
No, I didn't even have a suit on at the Grammys.
It really changed jazz, yeah, and improvisational music.
Yeah. It wasn't just the awards, it became a political statement. You see what it sparked. As much as everybody, there's moments in history when we look back. There's Dave Chappelle, there's Barack Obama, and then there's that time when Kendrick put out To Pimp a Butterfly. And it pushed, it made people uncomfortable, it made everything a bit disheveled, it brought the cream to the top, it shook everything up. And I think this album is definitely one of those albums that when we look back, it will stand the test of time.
Of course.
You know, it's just... thank Kendrick for being the vessel, you know what I mean, like letting it happen, because he could have easily been like, you know, I'm gonna just put out this trap album.
I think you have a trap album on the way. I think you're hitting.
You think I'm joking.
Love it. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Musician known as Thundercat. He spoke with The New Yorker's Brianna Younger last year. Thundercat goes on tour this month for his new album, It Is What It Is. That's The New Yorker Radio Hour for this week. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us. Please join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.